This is a top story to really kick off not just February, but I think it's a top story in recent months here in Connecticut. So the governor announced that he received the final report of the independent investigation into the audit concerning the Connecticut State Police fake ticket scandal. And as you know, Lamont ordered this report because of the release of the audit conducted by the Connecticut Racial Profiling Project Advisory Board. It had suggested that 81 active troopers and constables may have engaged in intentionally falsifying traffic stop data. In that final report, it said there have been significant failures by the Connecticut State Police when it comes to reporting racial profiling data under the Alvin Penn law. However, overall, it found no evidence of widespread misconduct. So I want to talk about this a little bit more with Andy Matthews, who is the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. He joins us now. And Andy came on when we first learned there was going to be an investigation into this potential scandal. So he's back on today with some response to this. Andy, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate the quick turnaround. How are you?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. So, Andy, let's start with what you thought when you heard about the release of this investigation and the findings.
Well, we were relieved and we felt vindicated on behalf of 900 troopers, sergeants and master sergeants, all the Connecticut troopers that we represent. This racial profiling prohibition project audit that came out in June of 2023, we have claimed from day one had serious flaws with the metrics that they used, the tactics that they used to come out with the data. They didn't fully understand how the agency worked and the lack of equipment necessary to properly record data. And we've spent the last 8 months being attacked. The integrity of the state police and those that represent our troopers have been attacked. We felt that we think that Governor Lamont deserves a lot of credit for his leadership, along with Senator Austin, Senator Ciccarelli, and Representative Howard, who continuously asked the public and legislators and members of the press to reserve judgment until all the facts were known. And the governor provided us with new leadership, which was encouraging based on some of the things he saw, and called for an independent, fair, and impartial investigation based on the audit. And Attorney Daley's report, which was released yesterday in part in the conclusion, says, however, the implications initially raised by the Connecticut racial profiling audit that as many as 130 troopers and constables may have engaged in intentional falsification of traffic data is not supported by the evidence. So we feel vindicated. We feel that if there were, because as you know, there's six troopers and one constable that have been reviewed to internal affairs, referred to internal affairs for further review. If there is misconduct, it was not a systemic widespread issue that they tried to tell the public was occurring. So.
Right. I want to kind of piggyback what you said. According to that final report, 74 of the 81 troopers and constables from the audit, it says, are unlikely to have intentionally falsified traffic stop data. And as you mentioned, six troopers and one constable have been referred to be further investigated for potentially intentionally falsifying data. But, you know, one of the biggest takeaways with this, Andy, is something that you and I talked about months ago over the summertime, which is that we sounded the alarm, the media, many groups across Connecticut sounding the alarm. And also, what bad timing, because in the last few years, cops especially have been scrutinized across the country, sounding the alarm that, oh my gosh, we have close to 200 troopers who have been doing this awful thing. This has been going on for almost a decade. And how are we monitoring them? How are we hiring them? How could we have these people representing us? I don't feel safe. You know what I'm getting at. The headlines right. that came out of this initial scandal, I mean, painted a really horrific picture for state police. I mean, remind me, weren't there state police troopers who were reporting that they were being threatened, their families were being threatened, they were being followed because of what initially came out with this report?
Yeah, that's accurate. And we provided evidence that there were threats made directly to take the lives of police officers that may do this type of conduct. So we took it pretty seriously. We even had to fight the media preserving the names of the 130 troopers we've been litigating for the last 6 months, 7 months, to protect those individual names, because we knew that the information was false. And some people, to your point, have a political agenda. Over the last several years, it's easy to attack law enforcement and make suggestions without any evidence to try to. They actually cause, and their motive is to undermine the public's confidence and trust in law enforcement. And then they suggest to the public that the conduct of 130 troopers undermines the public's trust. It's actually the reverse. They're doing it to us, and it's irreparable harm that is going to take a long time to repair. And we're focused on moving forward with new Commissioner Higgins and Colonel Lockman, who we believe possess the character, the leadership skill necessary to clean up this mess and move on. But we are going to very much focus on the racial profiling prohibition project and ensure that what they did to our agency doesn't occur to another law enforcement agency. Every chief of police in Connecticut should be concerned when the audits occur, because if there's not communication and transparency with both organizations that are doing an audit, and maybe even the unions or associations that represent the officers that do the job should be involved in the process so that this can never happen again to someone else.
And again, we have Andy Matthews here, and he's the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. We're talking about the outcome of an investigation that took about 6 months to complete, but looking into thousands of possibly falsified traffic tickets by state police, they ultimately found no evidence of widespread misconduct. And again, in the initial investigation, they were looking at over 130 troopers involved in this potential scandal. And now we're looking at 6 troopers, 1 constable, further investigating those individuals. But overall, what it sounded like, Andy, when you and I had talked about this when it initially happened, was there almost was like a breakdown of reporting, how troopers report in the field versus in office, the tasks that they're being given. I mean, how do we clean that up? So I have a two-part question. Yeah, I want to talk about that aspect, and then a bigger question, which is that how do we clean up the respect we have for troopers and police in general? So that's the second question, but I want to start with how do we clean up the issue at hand, which is how the reporting got messed up.
No, this is a great conversation. The public in your listeners should know that nobody ever received a fake ticket. This was all data. So one of the biggest problems in the history of the state police, and maybe even other agencies, is that if you don't have the proper tools in your cruiser, because the employer doesn't purchase the right equipment and equip every cruiser with an MDT, which is a computer, and you're calling information in over the radio to a dispatcher who has many other responsibilities, it's likely that that information, what we think the investigation discovered, was that that information, it wasn't the trooper that some in the media and some legislators tried to blame. It was the actual system. It was the IT platform. It was the computer, lack of the proper tools, which the governor said they're committed to making sure are out there. So if a trooper doesn't, they assume that the troopers intentionally falsified records regarding racial profiling ticket information. That's what Deirdre Daly's competent report discloses. That isn't true. There was no evidence. They rushed to judgment. So the most important thing is that the public needs to know it wasn't intentional. The way we recorded our data, and what Mr. Barone did was compare our data to the Centralized Infractions Bureau, which is where the tickets get returned from a citizen who gets a ticket. So they either turn it in not guilty and ask for a court date, or they pay the fine, right? So he took those two data dumps and tried to compare them, and they didn't match. He never compared. He never asked our employer, the state police headquarters, for copies of handwritten tickets. He compared electronic data from within the agency and the Centralized Infractions Bureau, and he messed up completely. And if he had simply taken the time, his group, taken the time to talk to our command staff more in depth, or even us as a union who represents the troopers, that this whole thing could have been avoided. So I think the governor is right. I think the governor is focused on giving us the proper leadership and the tools we need to make sure that this never happens again.
Top story today, for sure, has to do with the investigation into the thousands of possibly falsified traffic tickets by state police. They ultimately found no evidence of widespread misconduct. And we're talking with Andy Matthews, the executive director of the Connecticut State Police Union. And when this first broke over the summertime, I mean, there was a lot of uproar and we had Andy come on. And from the very beginning, he's been saying you've got the narrative all wrong. Not me personally, but like the public had the narrative all wrong. And one of the biggest reasons, Andy, is because it felt like the alarms were sounded right away. It does sound like maybe not all entities were spoken to as in-depth as they should have been. And there was a lot of misconception around this potential scandal. With that being said, and we're not saying that the outcome was perfect, certainly. As you mentioned, there are still seven people being investigated for this. But the majority of the people who were mentioned in this scandal ended up having really nothing to do with it. They didn't do anything wrong, essentially. And we know that systematically that's being worked on in the future. But the way this was handled, I think that has to be discussed because you've got two parts here. You've got the troopers, obviously, who were very negatively impacted because there was a trust issue now. There are questions whether or not they, you know, were doing something intentional. If they were racially profiling people in Connecticut, were they creating these fake tickets? I mean, horrible accusations against our troopers, mm-hmm. no matter who was in it or right. not. And then on the other side of it, though, you've got Connecticut residents who are saying, OK, wait, I want to feel like I'm in a safe place. I want to know that the men and women serving us are protecting our families, are not going to judge us, are going to do their jobs effectively. So there were two groups of people who I feel were very badly impacted because of the way this was handled. What would you and the Connecticut State Police Union like to see happen moving forward to avoid this?
You know, first, it proves that the public can't believe everything they see or hear or read, right? The other is that we can make sure that the people that did this should apologize first. And then we should make sure that the public understands that when people do commit misconduct, the union that represents the troopers and management hold our people accountable. The public knows, the majority of your listeners, and continuing to have these dialogues and having people like you educate the public that of the facts rather than listening to people that give false narratives is really the way we educate the public and we try to mend the harm that's been caused. But I think that, you know, what this did, it caused so much damage. It wasn't just our image they damaged. It's the morale of our troopers that they damaged. We have troopers that are not motivated to do motor vehicle activity because they feel they'll be considered racist or providing false information. It caused a lot of harm, but we can prevent it from happening. We got to at some point just put it behind us and try to be positive and try to mend, because there are people that won't hear this program and they'll just remember the negative false
exactly.
allegations that were made.
Exactly.
You know?
So. Mm-hmm. I mean, and look, and the other thing you can't really go without addressing the elephant in the room, Andy, is we still have a shortage of troopers. I mean, we are doing better. We're definitely getting more troopers, but we still don't have enough. We're not at the level we should be. And people, you know, want safer highways. They you know, they want all these things, but you need people to do it. And if we can't trust our troopers and we can't continue with a positive narrative for our troopers, who's going to want to be a trooper? Who's going to want to risk being threatened or putting their families in danger? Who's going to want to be abused on the job? No one wants to do that. So we have to get this right. We have to get this right. I mean, certainly no one is perfect. And if there was any sort of conduct that was, you know, was done improperly.
Yeah, there's a bad connection. I can't hear everything you're saying, but we are short-staffed. We've been short-staffed for several years. We're down about 300 troopers from our high of 1,283. So part of that can if the governor is focused, so is the Public Safety Committee. And the Appropriations Committee is focused on making sure we have the proper staffing levels. Problem is, because of all the attacks on law enforcement, We don't have many people that apply. We have about 1,000, just over 1,000 people that apply for 80 vacancies. We have a class of 40 that just entered. We're down to 38. So because of the attacks on law enforcement, years ago we'd have 12, 15,000 people apply. Now people aren't encouraged.
They're not encouraged to want to do this. Well, Andy, I think you make a lot of great points, and I want to thank you so much for coming on to WICC in response to this. It's I know our connection is going in and out as well for you.
Oh,
so
that's okay.
I think it was great to be able to have you on after the investigation findings, and I do hope you'll continue to come on and get the message out there, certainly.
Yeah, thank you for your support, and be safe to you and all your listeners.
Thank you, Andy. I really appreciate what you do, and thank you for taking the time. Andy Matthews, again, is the executive director for the Connecticut State Police Union, and he was here this morning talking about the investigation into those possibly falsified traffic tickets by state police, which ultimately found no evidence of widespread misconduct. I'm sure we'll have Andy back on the show again really soon. Mm-hmm. Recently, there was a panel discussion in Stamford. The governor was there, Mayor Caroline Simmons. And there were a lot of, I'd say, giants in the Northeast Corridor train sector that were there, Amtrak, Metro North, of course, Department of Transportation also in this meeting. And it's all about what is the future looking like, the near future even, here in Connecticut when it comes to our train systems and what upgrades and what enhancements are can we expect in the near future. So Josh Morgan is here. He was actually at that meeting and can give us a little bit of detail as to what we can expect over the next decade or two when it comes to our trains. Hey, Josh, welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Always great to be with you.
Always love having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time because I know how busy you are. So tell us a little bit about what we can look forward to. Let's start off with what was discussed in that panel meeting earlier this week.
Yeah, it really was insightful discussion about how over the next 15 years with sustained federal funding, the Northeast Corridor can really be transformed in the regards to new tracks, faster trains, more frequent service. It's really something that we're looking forward to, not only to get more people to use the train service, but to get people out of their cars to reduce traffic congestion and improve the greenhouse gas emissions in the state.
Yeah, I was going to kind of touch on that next, Josh, which is you know, during the pandemic, unfortunately, the trains suffered tremendously from ridership numbers. And I know that there are all these efforts to go green. And one of the things that we really do have going for us is the fact that we've got Metro North. We have train systems that will get us all the way directly to Washington, D.C., and we have them going all the way up to Boston, even up to Vermont. We have Amtrak. So we have a lot of great opportunities with the trains, and I know Connecticut has continued to invest in them, but ridership numbers, have we gotten anywhere close to, if not back to where we were pre-pandemic?
Yeah, on the New Haven line, we're about 73% recovered, so not fully back to where we were pre-pandemic, but ridership is on the rise. We're seeing great success along the Hartford line, where over the last few months, we've actually exceeded pre-pandemic ridership. And looking at the schedules, looking at the service, you know, we're trying to provide services that meet the needs of the riders of today. So what that means is that there's more trains running Monday to Thursday and on weekends than there are on Fridays, because the data is telling us that Friday is a day when people are most likely working from home. So there's far fewer riders going on the train. So we're keeping a close eye on that and, you know, certainly inviting people to come back to the rail service. It's a great way to travel.
So, Josh, if we continue to get our numbers up with ridership, I know that there was a lot of controversy over some of the recent announcements and changes in the beginning of the year, actually, having to do with our trains. One of those was the fact that the scheduling is not where it used to be. Some of the trains got cut as far as the hours of operation. But I think the bigger takeaway was the fact that it costs more to take the train. It's expensive to take the train today. And so I was curious if you think as ridership continues to go up, since there's such a push and there's so much investment in it, do you see the money that is spent on tickets? Do you see that going down anytime soon?
Yeah, there was about a 4.5% increase on fares this year across the rail lines in Connecticut. On the New Haven line, it was the first time in about 5 years that fares were increased. But you're absolutely right. The cost of electricity, the cost of labor, the cost of maintenance, all of that has gone up. We're fortunate that we have a governor and a legislature that is supportive of public transportation and is providing the state funding. So the ticket prices did not have to go up any more than that 4.5%. But when we look at the Northeast, the New Haven line, it really was surgical in the approach that we looked at when we had to adjust the schedules with the funding that we had available. What that meant was Monday to Thursday, there were two trains taken out of service. But there was a train 15 minutes on either side of those two trains that were removed. So a minimal impact on the New Haven line. And we were really looking at the data, looking at the ridership to find the trains to eliminate that were really being underutilized.
Josh Morgan is here from the Department of Transportation. And earlier this week, there was a panel discussion in Stamford, and they were discussing everything having to do with the trains on the Northeast Corridor, which, of course, includes us, includes Metro North. I was also curious about this, Josh. I recently actually took a trip into the city with my sisters, and even from Stamford into Grand Central takes an hour. And I know I live in Milford, so I will drive down 40 minutes to go to my sister's house in Stamford to get on the train, to still ride for almost an hour to get into Grand Central, which to me just is crazy. Speeding up the trains, I know this is a big thing, especially like in Europe and other parts of the country, or I should say other parts of the globe. Do we know if that is going to be made a massive priority here in Connecticut? Because I think that's a huge reason a lot of people don't want to take the train, is because it still takes ridiculously long. And it's like, it might as well at least be in control of no delays and just get in your car and drive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To, you know, people will use the service if it's convenient for them, right? So we need to increase speeds on the rail line. And really, over the next 15 years, that commute from Stamford to Grand Central is going to be faster. The people who are further up, you know, in New Haven coming down, you know, that trip to Grand Central will take the same time as that trip takes you from Stamford now. So there is a concerted effort to speed up the trains, but we have to do so safely. It was more than 10 years ago where there was a crash in Bridgeport on the rail line, which really put speed restrictions on the tracks and said you need to slow these trains down. You need to make sure your infrastructure is safe. And that's certainly first and foremost in our minds. And what this sustained federal funding means is that we can do these repairs. We can replace these 110-year-old railroad bridges that are in desperate need of repair and replacement. We can straighten some of the tracks. We can align some of the tracks, allowing these trains. The equipment can run faster than they're running on the lines. We just can't do so right now with the geometry and the layout of the track. So, yeah, certainly over the next 15 years, with this federal funding, you know, we're going to be able to make a big difference on rail travel through the region.
So it sounds like over the next 15 years, and when you say going faster, like how much faster?
Yeah, 10, 20, 30 miles an hour faster. The commitment here is that, we're going to save 25 minutes by 2035. You know, we're going to increase the speeds of our trains, but really we need to make sure that the infrastructure can support that, that we're making sure that what happened in 2013 doesn't happen again. We want to make sure that it's safe, reliable, and certainly we're going to be working on that. You know, over the last 20 years, there's never really been sustained federal funding. It would come, it would go. There was always money there for roads and bridges and highways. But now with the bipartisan infrastructure law, there was a five-year commitment to rail with increased funding and all these discretionary grants, which Connecticut won about $2 billion, billion with a B, to do these infrastructure work, which means the federal government, taxpayers across the country are helping improve the infrastructure here in Connecticut, because it's not just Connecticut residents that are using this. It's freight rail. It's commuter service through the region. And that makes a big difference that there's going to be about 90% federal funding on all these projects.
And we are back with Josh Morgan, who's with Connecticut Department of Transportation. We were just talking about the rails. Now let's move to the roads. Let's discuss some of the things that we're finding in recent reports for Connecticut. I know, Josh, I actually had AAA on not too long ago. Alex Slatke was here, and we were talking about the importance of the slowdown move over law, for example. And when he shared some of the data that they've collected recently, it proves that we're not doing a whole lot better when it comes to just protecting our first responders, for example, our tow truck drivers, people who are disabled on the side of the road. We're not doing a great job with that because of people who are distracted and people who are speeding. And, of course, you've got the people who are also impaired behind the wheel. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about just in general roadway deaths and what you have found, not to be kind of doom and gloom, but I do think that this is really important information and stuff that we need to continue bringing to people's attention. So what can you share with us?
Yeah, what we're seeing on our roadways, and, you know, I think anyone that's, you know, spent a day traveling throughout the state can probably attest to it, is that it is more dangerous. People are driving incredibly fast. They are not paying attention. They're too busy looking at their phones, being distracted. And also there's just an incredible rate of impaired drivers out there. Our data is showing us that 4 out of every 10 roadway deaths in Connecticut are the result of an impaired driver. And that's just completely unacceptable. Those are preventable deaths if people were just being responsible and doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, in the state, I know the Department of Transportation has tried, especially in the last couple of years, to, you know, implement new signage and really invest time and data and looking into these issues, especially because we know during the pandemic that we went through this really wacky thing where no one was driving in 2020 because everyone was working from home. Kids weren't in school for a good stretch of time. But then all of a sudden we established these really horrible habits. We really became kind of irresponsible drivers. And I say that very loosely. OK, I don't mean you and me or maybe even our listeners right now. I'm not trying to attack people. But as a whole, we've made our roadways not as safe. We've become more reckless. And so something that I've talked to law enforcement about a lot is the power of testing individuals. And I think you and I have talked about this before. But I'm wondering what the DOT thinks about when people renew their license, for example. Is there some kind of refresher course they can take in order to keep their license? I mean, with a lot of major workforce industries, they have to retest themselves. Doctors, insurance agents, attorneys, they have to retest themselves to make sure that they can remain in a responsible job helping the public. So it is interesting that as drivers, we don't have to retest or we don't have to to make sure we know the updated laws on the books for the roads and things like that. I do find that very interesting that we don't have to do that.
Yeah, and that's actually going to be changing because that's a very fair point. What happens is you get your license, you take that test once, and then you just renew it in perpetuity and never really get that refresher of roadway safety, any law changes. So actually last legislative session as part of a bill championed by Connecticut's Vision Zero Council, which our commissioner is the chair of, a provision passed and was signed into law that when people are renewing their licenses, they'll be required to go through a training video, to watch a video. So we're working with the Department of Motor Vehicles about the information to include in that, the dangers of impaired driving, the dangers of speeding and distracted driving, and any new law changes, you know, certainly incorporating slow down, move over laws. So that's something that's going to be rolling out in the near future. And hopefully it will make a difference when people are seeing that every time they renew their license every several years.
That's an excellent update. Was that just decided?
It didn't just happen yesterday. It was last legislative session that it was passed. It was part of the Vision Zero bill. A lot of the attention of that bill was focused on the automated traffic enforcement devices, the red light cameras, the speed cameras that municipalities are able to install on roadways moving forward. But in that bill, there was also a partnership with the DOT and the DMV to make these videos and have them available when people are renewing their licenses.
Oh, I think that's really great. And so this is something that's going to be available to them, not just at a Department of Motor Vehicles, but also if they do it online, because I know that we're becoming more and more online efficient with anything we need the DMV for. Wow, that's awesome.
Absolutely. You're not going to have to be at a branch office. You know, be able to do it, you know, right from your home on your computer, on your phone, be able to sit through that training video, which we think is going to be really impactful.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, and that's something you said that's going to roll out in the near future, like this year or?
Yeah, not sure if it'll be this year, but, you know, hopefully as soon as possible.
Okay. And anything else, Josh, that you're focused on with trying to fix this issue? It's a big one, so I'm not looking for you to have all the answers, but anything else that's being worked on currently?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to get the word out there. We're trying to remind people that the actions that they take behind the wheel could have life and death consequences. Far too often, people are saying, I'm just a little buzzed. I drive better when I'm high. These are all just misconceptions. They are not true. And we need people to take the responsibility of getting behind the wheel seriously, because if they don't, if they're speeding, if they're distracted, if they're impaired, that decision could kill themselves or somebody else. And again, I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer here on a beautiful Friday morning, but it's concerning when we see the number of deaths on our roadways at the highest level since the 1980s. Something has to change, and we really hope the public will join our efforts and really make a commitment to be safe behind the wheel.
Josh Morgan, I also want to thank you for coming on this platform. You always make yourself available to talk about these issues that matter a lot to all of us here listening. So thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll talk again very soon.
Yes, absolutely, Melissa. It's always great to be with you. And just before I go, if people want to check out that panel discussion, we actually have the video link pinned to our Twitter page at CTDOT Official, so people can go back and watch the hour-long discussion for themselves. And thank you again, Melissa. Always great to be with you.
No problem. Thank you. And again, Josh Morgan with the Connecticut Department of Transportation is right here on WICC.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM at 107.3 FM.
And it's certainly been a very busy week, including for Congressman Himes, who actually voted a few days ago to pass the bipartisan tax relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024. Want to kind of dive into this legislation. Good morning, Congressman Himes. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing great. Thank you.
Yeah, let's talk about this legislation, if you don't mind, and specifically what it would mean for Connecticut residents, the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024.
Yeah. Tax bills aren't usually that interesting to people, but this bill in particular had a couple of really good things. First, it passed with strong bipartisan support. Lots of Republicans, lots of Democrats. We don't see that a ton in the House of Representatives these days, so I was very happy to see that. And it really it does a lot of things, but most notably, you asked about Connecticut. Number one, it expands the child tax credit, and the child tax credit is actually a credit that a lot of people get. I think up to double income. Income of roughly $400,000, people get a little bit of cash associated with both working and having children. It's obviously much more generous for folks at the lower income scale, and I would point out that it was when it was expanded during the COVID era, it actually cut childhood poverty in this country in half. So a very effective tool for helping families with children in particular, who, of course, even though inflation is moderating, are still feeling that squeeze. So that's number one. Number two, and this is pretty important for our area, it expands and augments the low-income housing tax credit, which is actually the biggest tool we have for building affordable housing in this country. And so, you know, that will allow for the creation of more affordable housing that, you know, lets folks, again, on the lower income, lower end of the income ladder, have options. And then it had a bunch of tax relief for, and this is the one I would highlight, for businesses that are investing in research and development. That's important because, you know, at the end of the day, our strength, particularly down here in southwestern Connecticut, is innovation, and innovation comes when companies invest in research. And so, you know, all in all, I think a good, strong bipartisan bill.
Now, what I was reading this morning, Congressman Himes, is that the Senate might have a little more pushback from Republicans. In fact, I think I was reading that I don't remember which one, but there was a senator who was saying, I can't pass this merely because it's a presidential election year and this would make President Biden look good. I mean, how do we get this to go forward, especially when you have, I think that was the big headline, not the fact that it did pass, but the fact that it was strong bipartisan support in the House. I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. And a couple things. Number one, I expect the Senate will probably want to amend and change it. That's fine. That's their prerogative. But what you point out, yes, and I got to tell you, I'm hearing this on the border deal, which we haven't talked a lot about, but, you know, which I think is a really important deal, partly because it was negotiated by our very own Chris Murphy. I'm hearing that a lot. And, I mean, think about what somebody is saying when they say that. What they're saying is, this may be good for the American people. This may be good for my constituents. But I care so much about defeating President Biden that I'm going to deny the American people a win here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bad
luck. You know, I don't think that was anybody from Connecticut that said that. But anybody who's representative or senator says, you know, yeah, all right, this is a good bill, but we're not giving Joe Biden a win. You know, they got to be in a different business, and their constituents need to make sure they're in a different business.
Yeah. So we're talking to Congressman Jim Himes. We'll certainly see what's going to happen with that legislation as it now heads to the Senate. There's something else I've kept a really close eye on, and I know where Connecticut lawmakers in Washington, where we stand on this issue. But are you at all watching? I know this doesn't, you know, impact Connecticut in the sense that this didn't happen in Connecticut, thank God. We've had our own tragedies happen. Are you watching the Crumbly trial? Are you watching that at all? Are you familiar? Crumbly
what is
that's the Michigan shooter.
The parents.
I'm sorry, for
the actions of the kid.
Yes.
No, I'm not paying super close attention, but no, I'm certainly aware of it. And, you know, they're being charged on state charges. Yeah, remarkable question. I've been thinking about that. I'm not sure how I feel about it. You know, presumably, and I'm not even a lawyer, much less a criminal lawyer, but presumably the court, you know, the prosecutors are going to have to show that these parents exhibited, you know, gross negligence in allowing, as I understand it, a child who was clearly demonstrating, you know, significant mental health issues to allow that that child to have access to firearms. But man, yeah, I think this is unprecedented.
Yeah, I think the thing that's so hard to watch, Congressman Himes, so far as I'm watching it, I think is the big thing that obviously is, like you said, trying to be proven, which is negligence. And I haven't heard from the father yet. But the mother's not really impressing me at all. I mean, I think the thing that is really disturbing, and it's speaking to the need for mental health, is the fact that her son, there are text messages proving that she knew her son was going to probably do something dumb, is what she said. I think my son's going to do something dumb. She claimed she had to go to other meetings when she didn't. There's an alibi showing where exactly she was, which was having an affair. So there's a lot that's being shown in the court. And I guess the point of me bringing this up to you is, are there discussions? I know, as you mentioned, Chris Murphy has been a strong advocate in bringing more gun control because of the issues we've seen in school shootings, especially. But are there also discussions happening right now about also mental health and really making sure that, because they're looking at the school counselor, did he fail to do protocol correctly? I'm just wondering if that's something that lawmakers are looking at in Washington.
Yeah, big time. And by the way, let me point out, this absolutely did happen in Connecticut, right? Sandy Hook.
Right, exactly.
Adam Lanza, that kid was beyond disturbed, and the mother allowed, who ultimately paid with her life, of course, the mother allowed this individual, who was obviously very, very disturbed, to have a bunch of firearms, and she paid quite a price for it. But this is not, you know, a totally rare occurrence, even here in Connecticut. So to answer your question, two things. And in fact, the big bipartisan gun safety bill that was passed in the last Congress, it tightened up some regulations. It made it a little, it raised the age for somebody to be able to have access to an assault rifle, but it also invested substantial funds in mental health, because that's critical, well beyond firearms, right? You know, we're still hearing echoes, and I'm not sure anybody knows if it's sort of residual COVID stuff, kids being out of school, or whether it's social media or some combination thereof. but you know, mental health is a crisis. And then lastly, Melissa, let me, because you brought it up, I feel really strongly about this. You know, anybody in Connecticut, of course, focuses hard on gun violence because of what we all went through Sandy Hook. And we always talk about, you know, okay, additional restrictions, that's fine. I think there probably should be additional restrictions on what guns people can buy. You know, we talk about mental health. You know what we don't talk enough about? What is kind of behind the question you're asking, which is safety in gun-owning households, right? You know, what if we had either better voluntary compliance or better rules around, you know, if you have firearms in your home, fine, that's your constitutional right. But, you know, they need to be either kept locked up with, you know, ammunition separate, which is, I guess, the best practice there. Or, you know, we have things called trigger locks today where if for some reason you don't want to lock up your gun, you can't use it unless you know a combination, or they have more advanced technological ones. Now, the reason I say all that is that so much violence happens with stolen guns, suicides of a child because the child finds and has access to a parent's weapon. I think we never talk about it, but I think we could substantially reduce the brutal violence in this country if we just had more responsible, you know, storage and people just being more responsible about the firearms that they keep.
Well, and I am hoping that this is sort of a PSA moment, depending on how this trial ends up. But I think when you listen to the testimony of this mom, I also really do believe sometimes, Congressman Himes, you could pass as many laws as you want, but at the end of the day, people really need to sit and think about if you want to raise children. I'm listening to this mom who's like, I wouldn't change anything I did that day. Really? You wouldn't? You wouldn't change one thing you did that day because four kids died because your kid had a gun in his backpack. No one checked his backpack. No one thought there was enough wrong to say, hey, you know what? Why don't we come home? If a school counselor called me today about my son and said, I'm disturbed by his drawings, he's mentioning things that make me feel very nervous for his well-being, you could bet your bottom dollar he'd be out of school that day and in a counselor's office, or my husband and I would be doing an intervention, or we would be diving. I would not leave him in a school. You know, I wouldn't leave him there. And I question sometimes where parents' heads are at. You know, when I'm watching this, it's so frustrating because I do think we try to take, you know, sometimes more gun rights away. And I do think we're trying to invest in mental health. But at the end of the day, you have to ask the question, I mean, are you fit to be a parent? and we make mistakes, right? I'm not trying to judge people. But at the end of the day, like when you're listening to this woman, I think to myself, you wouldn't do anything different about that day. Really? It's crazy to me. It really is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, you know what? Your larger point is right. And I'm a legislator, right? I'm in the business of representing people and making laws that I hope that are good for them. But you're exactly right. You're exactly right. You know, a society can't run based on people simply being like robots abiding by the law.
Right.
I mean, on anything. You know, certainly on guns. I mean, yeah, the story, what you just said, yeah, of course, at a minimum, if your son had access or your child had access to firearms, you might lock them up for a couple of weeks or whatever. You know, we see this on political dialogue, too. You know, we can't make rules about how people talk to each other in the political realm, that people have a right of free expression. But, man, in households, let's model civility. Let's model humility. Let's model ways of talking to each other, you know, that are constructive and uplifting and that allow us to sort of hammer out our differences. There's so much we could do, I think, and I say this as a parent, too. There's so much we could do in the house that have nothing to do with laws or regulations that I think would create a much better society.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Congressman Himes, I appreciate you coming on and talking about some of these big topics, and we'll check in again with you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
Thanks. You too.